Misrepresentation is dangerous because in greenwashing, we have messaging that promotes false solutions to the climate crisis and delays the kind of climate action that we really need to be taking. Corporation is reassuring us that that they're already doing the things that need to happen, and they have the plan. You know, the Pathways Alliance is all about presenting this kind of plan for net zero that is deeply misleading.
That's just one example local to Canada, but this is happening around the world.
To me, the cycle that we're in here is that we have this false solution being presented to industry. So then we have the public relying on people that are in the industry to say, no, 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 we've got this, right? So I'm telling my friends, oh, yeah, yeah, we're doing CCS. And then what happens is the government officials, so these politicians, then feel obligated to support the public because they're angry and they want to make sure that our industry is being looked after. They go as far as to, there was an excellent article that the Narwhal did, have recordings of TC Energy executives talking about their relationship with the US government and how they are driving these messages through to policy. I can say this, I was a lobbyist. I didn't appreciate that I was a lobbyist, but I was writing letters to the government. Now, from my point of view, I can be confident in that I was writing letters about site restoration. The message that I was making to government is, if we want Indigenous participation, it needs to be in site cleanup. It cannot be in carbon capture and storage. And who better to lead that, this was my messaging to the government, than Indigenous communities that have faced this issue for decades.
I read a different section of Bill C-59. And in that section, what they talk about is a tax credit on carbon capture utilization and storage. It's a kind of omnibus bill. So there's a whole bunch of things in the bill, including that part in greenwashing, different stuff on unemployment insurance and so on. And it touches about everything that's in the budget, kind of an example of greenwashing. On the one hand, you have a law against greenwashing that also includes provisions that support continued use of production of and use of fossil fuels. And there's also another part, another tax credit on clean industry investments, which is very interesting. It's a bunch of a tax credit on renewable solar, wind, which also includes nuclear. So there's tax credit for nuclear power plants, specifically targeted at small nuclear reactors, small modular nuclear reactors, which the oil industry is looking to use in decarbonizing its production.
It's not a new problem in West Texas. It's the tragedy of the commons. And where I am, everyone's like, oh, it's just mesquite, you know, scrub brush, and you can see here. Okay, well, 100 years ago, it was all beautiful grasslands and we overgrazed it. And then after we overgrazed it, we started punching holes in it and we're abusing it. Like, I think that we just need to be having discussions about what the future looks like for our grandchildren. And we're injecting CO2 into the ground, which is the dumbest thing ever, because all we know is we're going to create carbonic acid when that CO2 mixes with the water, and carbonic acid is highly corrosive and eats through the steel and the cement even more. And Oxy's spending billions of dollars a few miles away from me with these direct air capture, big old fans in the middle of the desert, and they're going to suck the CO2 out and inject it into the San Andres Formation, which is the same formation that is feeding this water right here in the picture.
In California, you have a company called CRC. It hasn't existed for very long. It's really the old assets of Oxy, Shell, and Exxon. They own more wells than anyone else in California. They do not have the money to pay for the cleanup. They actually went bankrupt shortly after they were spun off from Oxy. So they recently, with California's new regulatory structure, agreed to merge with another large oil company with a lot of Exxon's old assets. These two companies merged, and all the activists were like, this is going to be great. The new law says they owe us $1 billion to cover these assets. But as I like to say, the oil and gas industry lawyers and lobbyists are some of the best and normally wrote the laws. What happened was they said, oh no, this is a merger. In California, if you do a merger, you don't have to pony up that $1 billion. So here we have Colorado. They're doing worse than when they started the process. California just handed a gift to a company. And the additional part of this Ponzi scheme, this is what the U.S. shale industry has been on several levels. Now what CRC is saying is, we're a carbon capture company.
In the 1990s to about the year 2000, the regulator and government of the day in Alberta started to notice that there was some risk, and there was some risk of bankruptcies. And the regulator also was concerned with the number of transfers of wells from the big companies that originally drilled these wells to mom and pop operations, etc. So they wanted to start imposing security deposits against these closure costs, and they wanted to start regulating, monitoring these transfers. And industry said, no, don't do that to us. Let us transfer our licenses to whomever we want, and don't make us put up security deposits to cover end of life obligations. And in return, we will like insure against bankruptcy of our members. So we got something, it's unique. I think it's probably the envy of the world. It's called the Orphan Fund. It's legislated under Part 11 of the Oil and Gas Conservation Act. So there's a yearly levy that's supposed to occur. They're trying to renege on their deal. They're trying to say, well, now that's time for us to pay. We don't want to keep the promise we made.
I hear the concept of love brought up a great deal. And it's one that I don't think a lot of people are truly listening to. What is decolonization? I just kind of threw these elements on the table, but I didn't give you my real opinion about it. But we're not going to be able to move forward without some violence. It's just going to happen. It's happening. Whenever, you know, Wet'suwet'en is a perfect example of that violence. What happened with the Woodland Cree just recently on their lands, you know, trying to get an injunction to put the chief in jail. Like, it's never been done. It's unprecedented. But yet they're doing it. That's a violence. That's what we're up against. That's the reality. That's not nicey-nicey, come to the table, have earnest. No, it's like, we want that. And we're going to take it regardless. And we're going to arrest you and throw you in jail or shoot you in the process. I find that there's a massive difference between indigenizing and colonizing. And some things just cannot be indigenized. And that's just a simple fact. Yet indigenizing in most cases is more or less to do with colonial systems, that it has to do with deconstructing education, for example, which is what I'm trying to do. For me, when we work to indigenize our home territories, how does the rest of the population gain insight from that? Well, I'm not quite sure they're ready. Because just like you were pointing out earlier about this, the reality is that we, as a culture, as peoples, our peoples have been trying to educate about our worldview since contact, and it's not registering, and it's just not. And that's a lot of years to be going to school, you know, for people. I mean, like, for people who've been here that long, who have ancestors that arrived here in those early days and are still here, they've had an education from us and still not taking any cues.
There isn't going to be any peace without some violence of some sort. To us, violence is standing up, using our voices and saying, no, we're not going to take this anymore, and pushing back. And I don't think that a lot of the European world or the colonized world understands that. We weren't violent unless we had to be violent, you know, unless it was pushed upon us and then we were violent in return. So in that sense, I do believe that what he's saying is 1,000% true. And a lot of people my age, the Blackfoot language wasn't spoken in our home. It wasn't taught to us because our parents wanted us to be colonized. Our parents wanted us to fit in the white world. And so, oh no, don't do that, because they themselves were part of residential schools. And so they were punished for it. They didn't want the same things to happen to us. You think of home, you think of what? You think of Chief Mountain, you think of, you know, there's landmarks that we identify with. And so I think that if we find those commonalities and we start to work together, that's how decolonization actually happens. But as far as what I'm working on a lot of little things. But it's crazy because the film that that we're premiering actually talks about the work that my, he's my cousin, but we're like 6 months apart, so we're kind of brothers. He's trying to bring culture back to the Blackfeet. He's trying to do that. And the resistance that he's meeting head on is giving me like a bird's eye view of what could actually happen if we start to lose those things. And there's a lot of things that have we as Ganawa have lost over time. And that's where colonization just never stops. You know, we want to fit in. We want to be like the cool rappers, and we don't want to be like the cool educational people or the elders. We don't look to our elders, or our youth don't look to our elders the way that they look to famous people now. And so I think a lot of that needs to be taken apart and put back together so that they understand that our future generations do rely on them, just like it relies on us. And there's something that Tyson says a lot that I've kind of adopted too is, well, if I don't do it, then who's going to? If not me, then who? No, if I don't, who's going to? That's kind of what I'm doing.
Yes.
I need clarity and to make some sense about exactly what has been going on in not just my life, but the lives of so many people, like all of us. It's like, why is it that when I was a kid, I grew up and I went through the social studies curriculum, and the closest thing I could find about Native people was that we were part of the local wildlife, that I grew up on a reserve, and and it was okay. And you know what? Wild animals are in Africa, and they're on wild animal reserves, and nobody questioned it. Like, okay, so everybody is okay that I'm on a reserve, a little kid on a reserve. I don't get to learn anything about anything. My parents talk in Blackfoot in the next room. They whisper about it, but they don't talk to me in Blackfoot unless I'm in trouble. You know, clarity involves sense making and meaning making. Now, does it make sense if I flip it and all of a sudden, Liz, Tara, KJ, we get together and we develop our white awareness training and we give that to Indigenous people? It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. So why do we accept it when, and we say, oh, okay, you know, professional development training, let's do some Indigenous awareness training. Oh, that's cool. You know what my parents got for white awareness training? The Indian residential schools. That's what we got. We still live in this existence that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And our first teachers, the land, the animal nations, we've completely disregarded them, completely. They're totally out of the, you know, and then so we get into questions about how are we going to manage the land? And it doesn't even make any sense to me. It's still, okay, I'm going to go to Liz and say, how am I going to manage Liz? Like, the land is living. It's alive. Why do we need to manage it?
You know, like, colonization is violent against us every single day. And now that we're speaking up and saying enough is enough, as Liz said, enough's enough. I'm not dealing with this no more. We're the ones that are looked at as violent. If that's the case, if me using my voice and standing my ground and standing in my knowledge ways and in my heart work is violent to somebody, then so be it. Because that's how I know that I'm going to make sure my son doesn't inherit all this hurt. Going back to I mentioned earlier that I've worked in behavioral health for many years now. A lot of it's been youth focused. What I always heard growing up was, you're the future. You're the one that makes those changes. But I'm realizing now, no, that's a cop out. We're the ones that make those changes because our kids inherit the choices we make today. We are their future. We're the ones that make that those choices to help guide them. You know, we're the ones that really do make the decision of what tomorrow is going to be like for them. And so I'm always challenging that now, anytime I hear it, you know, because the truth is, colonization is even violent against our generations and our community. We have so many people not even making it to elderhood. I don't even have family reunions anymore. We just have funerals. Going back to that, like I said, my heart work is showing up every day and just being brave enough to live in this world, to continue on, and still trying to live in love. Could probably go out there and just be colonized and try to turn a blind eye, and life would probably be easier for me. You know, I could do these terrible things and try to get ahead, But the truth is my heart would never allow it. I'd be just as miserable. And so anytime I come up this space where I have to be strong and igakuma, you know, and keep moving forward, I always ask myself that, you know, like, could you live with this? Not doing anything, moving forward, you know, could you live your life and like ignore something that you know is an injustice or that isn't the right thing? And if so, sometimes I can, but sometimes I know I couldn't live with myself. I'm showing up in these spaces and I'm telling my story, but more importantly, I'm listening and I'm learning and I'm making sure that whenever I transfer this knowledge to somebody else, especially our youth, that I'm doing it in a good way. The way that we make sure tomorrow is healed is that we heal today. We don't save it for tomorrow. No more. We don't have time. We're running out of time.
Algorithm is cherry picking information for you, and you're not seeing a whole bunch of other stuff that might be contrary. So like a confirmation bias that's digitally created is creating a social discohesion that actually needs to be somehow repaired or rectified. I'm not going to pretend to know I know how to do that, but I've gotten to the truth to the level of where I know that's exactly what needs to be done. And I think that is sociologically, culturally, and societally, and spiritually, one of the biggest challenges that we're facing today. And that's part of the reasons why I'm just not quitting.
I want to feel that I have tried to bring people together in ways that serve all of us. And so that I feel good when I go to sleep at night. I can go to sleep and know I tried my best for not only my family, but for Alex's and for you. And that's the great thing about knowing this. Once you know that, you don't need to worry about, you know, if this is good for my son, then somebody's going to lose. No, when you think in this way that serves others, it's very satisfying work to do, but it's hard work to do. It's something that's long-term, like you described. It's something that we don't necessarily get to enjoy. My friend Elise says it's type 2 fun. You know, type 2 fun translates into type 3 fun and type 4 fun and type, you know, on and on and on. And I think that's the benefit of the work we've now done. And I'm hopeful that we're in a place now where we can just enjoy the benefits of what we've worked towards and get into a bit of a rhythm and have some fun.
You have to do the inner work. And you started off with that, you know, the devil within, the saboteurs, whatever it is, it's the most effective that we can be in changing others is by doing the inner work, right? Doing the inner work, really understanding where we are. And then that ripples out, right? It becomes less about trying to force. And you said easy, Jenny, and that's ease and flow is very much a sage principle that, you know, and that starts from within. If I have that ease within myself and I have that sense of who I am and why I'm here, then it just becomes an easier path. And then you can be more intentional around where you're headed because you're grounded in yourself. The future is bright.
Music can inspire meaningful change. So my song, and I grew up listening to a variety of things, but the Guess Who was one of my favorite bands when I was in high school. I chose Do You Miss Me, Darling. We have a lot of learning to do and a lot of things to come together on that isn't easy. And if we try and walk it along, we're not going to get anywhere. We need to actually rush. So I think music is the best way for us to do that.
I think my favorite song to, like, you know, make me feel hopeful about the future or even just like my day to day, just to put me in a good mindset, is This Is the Day by The. And the majority of the song is that this is the day that your life will surely change. And, you know, it's true for everyone that your life changes every day. And, you know, if you're not striving for change in your life, then, you know, what are you really doing?
We're still fighting the gravel pit that we figure is going to ruin both our water and the water and the whole atmosphere for the Big Hill Springs Provincial Park. I've got a real song. It just popped into my head just because of the continual fight. And I think it's called High Hopes, and I don't have a clue. I've got high hopes, and it goes on and on about all the things that people try to do. Well, people, animals, anything, and never give up. They just keep at it.
My song is actually Adiago of strings on my third near-death experience. That was the first song that popped into my head. When you go through some stuff that really hits you, and you are given an option to either choose to live or choose to die, and then a song comes in, not of your own choice, it just stays with you. It focuses in on one rose in a row of rose bushes, right? And it helps you to come to the understanding that you are that rose amidst a row of others, right? You're all part of the same bush.
My song is an oldie but a goodie, but not that old. But it's from our Canadian singer, songwriter, activist, performer extraordinaire, Sarah Harmer. And the song is called Lodestar. Out on the night, out on the water, we pull the boat back to shore. Breathe in the air and the stillness of the bay. Intensity of stars reflected in the water. Silently ignite. The ore dips in to oil like water, and we are away. And I just love that with the strings, and then it just like the tempo of the song builds into crescendo, and then she brings it back in into this really intimate, you're alone in the world on a beach with someone you love. And it's a great song.
One of the songs that I picked is Famous Blue Raincoat by Leonard Cohen. It's about what's taken. It's what's taken from us, but what are we taking? And it's what are we trying to keep? And so Jane is the focus of this song. And when I think about what everybody's talking about here, about our water, about, it's not even our water, it's like we belong to the water and we belong to the land. And I think, you know, when we reframe things, and who is Jane? You know, she's the focus of this song, but who is she? Jane represents that which sustains us, which is the our earth, the earth that we belong to. That's what she symbolizes.
The song that a Neil Young song called Spirit Road, a speck of dust in a giant's world. There's a spirit road that you must find, a long highway in your mind. Don't feed the snake. It'll turn on you. You starve it out. That's what you do. And it makes you lie. It makes you cheat. It steals your shoes and it cuts your feet. That I think is referring to, or at least how I interpret it, is modernity and society and ego telling you one story, but your soul or your spirit has a deeper story that wants you to come back to it. And then in that, you have gifts to offer to your friends and your neighbors and to your land, to the land and to the water. And that deeper story is what I hope more of us can find in that long highway in our minds.
This is really timely because the song that you're going to hear is being released in 11 days. The way I write music is I create spaces that I want to feel things in, if that makes any sense. So this was like a really, this is coming from a perspective of how am I going to, what is my perspective going to be on my life after I die? It's a place I like to think in and feel in, just to kind of think about, you know, how am I living? What's happened? What am I happy with, not happy with? And I don't really like to like just grab random lines from songs. I think they all matter, but I think probably the most poignant line is like, we are never the person we are aching to be. The song's called Glad, Sad, Mad, Rad.
Creating a playlist. I think of something that's, I guess it harkens back to being of like grand importance in a weird way. The two musicians that probably had a greatest impact on me, aside from, you know, American ones, was Fela Kuti. When I was 18, discovering Fela Kuti was like groundbreaking. And, you know, of course, you know, you could go through his works and stuff, and there's just endless material, but No Agreement is probably like masterclass of African funk. And And I guess, you know, the reprisal against colonialism and the systems suppression and the need for creativity and the self-empowerment and everything else that comes with that.